Own. Hurry now, and the Great Mother give you speed and luck. They heard him go, a scrambling in the blackness. Jessica found Paul's hand, pulled him gently. We must not get separated, she said. Yes. He followed her across the first arrow, seeing it go black as they touched it. Another arrow beckoned ahead. They crossed it, saw it extinguish itself, saw another arrow ahead. They were running now. Plans within plans within plans within plans, Jessica thought. Have we become part of someone else's plan now? The arrows led them around turnings, past side openings only dimly sensed in the faint luminescence. Their way slanted downward for a time, then up, ever up. They came finally to steps, rounded a corner, and were brought short by a glowing wall with a dark handle visible in its center. Paul pressed the handle. The wall swung away from them. Light flared to reveal a rock-hewn cavern with an ornithopter squatting in its center. A flat gray wall with a door sign on it loomed beyond the aircraft. "Where did Kynes go?" Jessica asked. "He did what any good guerrilla leader would," Paul said. "He separated us into two parties and arranged that he couldn't reveal where we are if he's captured. He won't really know." Paul drew her into the room, noting how their feet kicked up dust on the floor. "No one's been here for a long time," he said. "He seemed confident the Fremen could find us," she said. "I share that confidence." Paul released her hand, crossed to the ornithopter's left door, opened it, and secured his pack in the rear. "This ship's proximity masked," he said. "Instrument panel has remote door control, light control. 80 years under the Harkonnens taught them to be thorough." Jessica leaned against the craft's other side, catching her breath. "The Harkonnens will have a covering force over this area," she said. "They're not stupid." She considered her direction sense, pointed right. "The storm we saw is that way." Paul nodded, fighting an abrupt reluctance to move. He knew its cause, but found no help in the knowledge. Somewhere this night he had passed a decision nexus into the deep unknown. He knew the time area surrounding them, but the here and now existed as a place of mystery. It was as though he had seen himself from a distance go out of sight down into a valley. Of the countless paths up out of that valley, some might carry a Paul Atreides back into sight, but many would not. "The longer we wait, the better prepared they'll be," Jessica said. "Get in and strap yourself down," he said. He joined her in the ornithopter, still wrestling with the thought that this was blind ground, unseen in any prescient vision. And he realized with an abrupt sense of shock that he had been giving more and more reliance to prescient memory, and it had weakened him for this particular emergency. "If you rely only on your eyes, your other senses weaken." It was a Bene Gesserit axiom. He took it to himself now, promising never again to fall into that trap. If he lived through this. Paul fastened his safety harness, saw that his mother was secure, checked the aircraft. The wings were at full spread rest, their delicate metal interleavings extended. He touched the retractor bar, watched the wings shorten for jet boost takeoff the way Gurney Halleck had taught him. The starter switch moved easily. Dials on the instrument panel came alive as the jet pods were armed. Turbines began their low hissing. "Ready?" he asked.
"Yes."
He touched the remote control for lights. Darkness blanketed them. His hand was a shadow against the luminous dials as he tripped the remote door control. Grating sounded ahead of them. A cascade of sand swished away to silence. A dusty breeze touched Paul's cheeks. He closed his door, feeling the sudden pressure. A wide patch of dust-blurred stars framed in angular darkness appeared where the door wall had been. Starlight defined a shelf beyond, a suggestion of sand ripples. Paul depressed the glowing action-sequence switch on his panel. The wings snapped back and down, hurling the thopter out of its nest. Power surged from the jet pods as the wings locked into lift attitude. Jessica let her hands ride lightly on the dual controls, feeling the sureness of her son's movements. She was frightened, yet exhilarated. "Now Paul's training is our only hope," she thought. "His youth and swiftness." Paul fed more power to the jet pods. The thopter banked, sinking them into their seats as a dark wall lifted against the stars ahead. He gave the craft more wing, more power, another burst of lifting wing beats, and they came out over rocks, silver-frosted angles and outcroppings in the starlight. The dust-reddened second moon showed itself above the horizon to their right, defining the ribbon trail of the storm. Paul's hands danced over the controls, wings snicked into beetle stubs. G-force pulled at their flesh as the craft came around in a tight bank. "Jet flares behind us," Jessica said. "I saw them." He slammed the power arm forward. Their thopter leaped like a frightened animal, surged southwest toward the storm and the great curve of desert. In the near distance, Paul saw scattered shadows telling where the line of rocks ended, the basement complex sinking beneath the dunes. Beyond stretched moonlit fingernail shadows, dunes diminishing one into another. And above the horizon climbed the flat immensity of the storm like a wall against the stars. Something jarred the thopter. "Shell burst," Jessica gasped. "They're using some kind of projectile weapon." She saw a sudden animal grin on Paul's face. "They seem to be avoiding their laser guns," he said. "But we've no shields. Do they know that?" Again the thopter shuddered. Paul twisted to peer back. "Only one of them appears to be fast enough to keep up with us." He returned his attention to their course, watching the storm wall grow high in front of them. It loomed like a tangible solid. "Projectile launchers, rockets, all the ancient weaponry. That's one thing we'll give the Fremen," Paul whispered. "The storm," Jessica said. "Hadn't you better turn?" "What about the ship behind us? He's pulling up." "Now!" Paul stubbed the wings, banked hard left into the deceptively slow boiling of the storm wall, felt his cheeks pull in the G-force. They appeared to glide into a slow clouding of dust that grew heavier and heavier until it blotted out the desert and the moon. The aircraft became a long, horizontal whisper of darkness, lighted only by the green luminosity of the instrument panel. Through Jessica's mind flashed all the warnings about such storms, that they cut metal like butter, etched flesh to bone, and ate away the bones. She felt the buffeting of dust-blanketed wind. It twisted them as Paul fought the controls. She saw him chop the power, felt the ship buck. The metal around them hissed and trembled. "Sand!" Jessica shouted. She saw the negative shake of his head in the light from the panel. Not much sand this high, but she could feel them sinking deeper into the maelstrom. Paul sent the wings to their full soaring length, heard them creak with the strain. He kept his eyes fixed on the instruments, gliding by instinct, fighting for altitude. The sound of their passage diminished. The thopter began rolling off to the left. Paul focused on the glowing globe within the attitude curve, fought his craft back to level flight. Jessica had the eerie feeling that they were standing still, that all motion was external. A vague tan flowing against the windows, a rumbling hiss, reminded her of the powers around them. "Winds to 700 or 800 kilometers an hour," she thought. Adrenaline edginess gnawed at her. "I must not fear," she told herself, mouthing the words of the Bene Gesserit litany. "Fear is the mind killer." Slowly her long years of training prevailed. Calmness returned. "We have the tiger by the tail," Paul whispered. "We can't go down, can't land, and I don't think I can lift us out of this. We'll have to ride it out." Calmness drained out of her. Jessica felt her teeth chattering, clamped them together. Then she heard Paul's voice, low and controlled, reciting the litany. "Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I will permit it to pass over me and through me. And when it has gone past me, I will turn to see fear's path. Where the fear has gone, there will be nothing. Only I will remain."
This ends Disc 9. Dune, Disc 10.
"What do you despise? By this are you truly known." From Manuel of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan.
"They are dead, Baron," said Yakin Nefud, the guard captain. "Both the woman and the boy are certainly dead."
The Baron Vladimir Harkonnen sat up in the sleep suspensors of his private quarters. Beyond these quarters, and enclosing him like a multi-shelled egg, stretched the space frigate he had grounded on Arrakis. Here in his quarters, though, The ship's harsh metal was disguised with draperies, with fabric paddings and rare art objects. "It is a certainty," the guard captain said. "They are dead." The Baron shifted his gross body in the suspensors, focused his attention on an ebony statue of a leaping boy in a niche across the room. Sleep faded from him. He straightened the padded suspensor beneath the fat folds of his neck, stared across the single glow globe of his bedchamber to the doorway where Captain Nefud stood blocked by the pentashield. "They're certainly dead, Baron," the man repeated. The Baron noted the trace of Samuta dullness in Nefud's eyes. It was obvious the man had been deep within the drug's rapture when he received this report, and had stopped only to take the antidote before rushing here. "I have a full report," Nefud said.
"Let him sweat a little," the Baron thought. "One must always keep the tools of statecraft sharp and ready. Power and fear, sharp and ready." "Have you seen their bodies?" the Baron rumbled.
Nefud hesitated.
"Well?"
"Milord, they were seen to dive into a sandstorm. Winds over 800 kilometers. Nothing survives such a storm, milord. Nothing. One of our own craft was destroyed in the pursuit."
The Baron stared at Nefud, noting the nervous twitch in the scissors line of the man's jaw muscles, the way the chin moved as Nefud swallowed.
"You have seen the bodies?"
the Baron asked.
"My lord?"
"For what purpose do you come here rattling your armor?"
the Baron roared.
"To tell me a thing is certain when it is not? Do you think I'll praise you for such stupidity, give you another promotion?"
Nefud's face went bone pale.
"Look at the chicken," the Baron thought. "I am surrounded by such useless clods. If I scattered sand before this creature and told him it was grain, he'd peck at it." "The man Idaho led us to them, then?"
the Baron asked.
"Yes, my lord."
"Look how he blurts out his answer,"
the Baron thought. He said,
"They were attempting to flee to the Fremen, eh?"
"Yes, my lord."
"Is there more to this report?"
"The Imperial Planetologist Kynes is involved, my lord. Idaho joined this Kynes under mysterious circumstances. I might even say suspicious circumstances."
"So?"
"They, fled together to a place in the desert where it's apparent the boy and his mother were hiding. In the excitement of the chase, several of our groups were caught in a lasgun shield explosion."
"How many did we lose?"
"I'm, not sure yet, my lord."
"He's lying," the Baron thought. "It must have been pretty bad." "The Imperial lackey, this Kynes," the Baron said. "He was playing a double game, eh?"
"I'd stake my reputation on it, my lord."
"His reputation." "Have the man killed," the Baron said.
"My lord, Kynes is the Imperial Planetologist. His Majesty's own serf—"
"Make it look like an accident, then."
"My lord, there were Sardaukar with our forces in the subjugation of this Fremen nest. They have Kynes in custody now."
"Get him away from them. Say I wish to question him."
"If they demur—"
"They will not, if you handle it correctly."
Nefud swallowed. "Yes, my lord."
"The man must die,"
the Baron rumbled.
"He tried to help my enemies."
Nefud shifted from one foot to the other.
"Well?"
"My lord, the Sardaukar have 2 persons in custody who might be of interest to you. They've caught the Duke's Master of Assassins."
"Hawat. Thufir Hawat."
"I've seen the captive myself, my lord. 'Tis Hawat."
"I'd not have believed it possible."
"They say he was knocked out by a stunner, my lord. In the desert where he couldn't use his shield, he's virtually unharmed. If we can get our hands on him, he'll provide great sport."
"This is a mentat you speak of,"
the Baron growled. "One doesn't waste a mentat."
"Has he spoken? What does he say of his defeat? Could he know the extent of—" "But no."
"He has spoken only enough, my lord, to reveal his belief that the Lady Jessica was his betrayer.
Ah.
The Baron sank back, thinking. Then,
you're sure it's the Lady Jessica who attracts his anger?
He said it in my presence, my lord.
Let him think she's alive, then.
But, my lord, be quiet.
I wish Howatt treated kindly. He must be told nothing of the late Dr. Yue, his true betrayer. Let it be said that Dr. Yue died defending his duke. In a way, this may even be true. We will instead feed his suspicions against the Lady Jessica.
Milord, I don't...
The way to control and direct Emmentat Nefud is through his information. False information. False results.
Yes, my lord, but
is Howard hungry, thirsty?
My lord, Howard's still in the hands of the Sardaukar.
Yes, indeed, yes, but the Sardaukar will be as anxious to get information from Howard as I am. I've noticed a thing about our allies, Nefud. They're not very devious, politically. I do believe this is a deliberate thing. The Emperor wants it that way. Yes, I do believe it. You will remind the Sardaukar commander of my renown at obtaining information from reluctant subjects.
Nefud looked unhappy. Yes, my lord.
You will tell the Sardaukar commander that I wish to question both Howard and this Kynes at the same time, playing one off against the other. He can understand that much, I think.
Yes, my lord.
And once we have them in our hands...
The Baron nodded. My lord, the Sardaukar will want an observer with you during any questioning.
I'm sure we can produce an emergency to draw off any unwanted observers, Nefud.
I understand, my lord. That's when Kynes can have his accident.
Both Kynes and Howatt will have accidents then, Nefud, but only Kynes will have a real accident. It's Howatt I want, yes. Ah, yes.
Nefud blinked, swallowed. He appeared about to ask a question, but remained silent.
Howard would be given both food and drink,
the Baron said.
Treated with kindness, with sympathy. In his water, he will administer the residual poison developed by the late Piter de Vries, and you will see that the antidote becomes a regular part of Howard's diet from this point on, unless I say otherwise.
The antidote, yes. Nefud shook his head.
But don't be dense, Nefud. The Duke almost killed me with that poison capsule tooth. The gas he exhaled into my presence deprived me of my most valuable mentat, Piter. I need a replacement.
Howard?
Howard.
But
you're going to say Howard's completely loyal to the Atreides.
True.
But the Atreides are dead. We will woo him. He must be convinced he's not to blame for the Duke's demise. It was all the doing of that Bene Gesserit witch. He had an inferior master, one whose reason was clouded by emotion. Mentats admire the ability to calculate without emotion, Nefud. We will woo the formidable Thufir Howatt.
Woo him? Yes, my lord.
Howatt, unfortunately, had a master whose resources were poor, one who could not elevate a mentat to the sublime peaks of reasoning that are a mentat's right. Howard will see a certain element of truth in this. The Duke couldn't afford the most efficient spies to provide his mentat with the required information.
The Baron stared at Nefud.
Let us never deceive ourselves, Nefud. The truth is a powerful weapon. We know how we overwhelmed the Atreides. Howard knows, too. We did it with wealth.
With wealth, yes, my lord.
We will woo Hawat, the Baron said. We will hide him from the Sardukar, and we will hold in reserve the withdrawal of the antidote for the poison. There's no way of removing the residual poison, and Nefud Hawat need never suspect. The antidote will not betray itself to a poison snooper. Hawat can scan his food as he pleases and detect no trace of poison.
Nefud's eyes opened wide with understanding.
The absence of a thing, the Baron said, this can be as deadly as the presence. The absence of air, eh? The absence of water. The absence of anything else we're addicted to.
The Baron nodded.
You understand me, Nefud?
Nefud swallowed.
Yes, my lord. Then get busy. Find the Sardukar commander and set things in motion.
At once, my lord. Nefud bowed, turned, and hurried away.
Hawat by my side, the Baron thought. The Sardukar will give him to me. If they suspect anything at all, it's that I wish to destroy the Mentat, and this suspicion I'll confirm. The fools! One of the most formidable Mentats in all history. A Mentat trained to kill. And they'll toss him to me like some silly toy to be broken. I will show them what use can be made of such a toy.
The Baron reached beneath a drapery beside his suspensor bed, pressed a button to summon his older nephew, Raban. He sat back, smiling.
And all the Atreides dead.
The stupid guard captain had been right, of course. Certainly nothing survived in the path of a sandblast storm on Arrakis. Not an ornithopter or its occupants. The woman and the boy were dead. The bribes in the right places, the unthinkable expenditure to bring overwhelming military force down onto one planet, all the sly reports tailored for the Emperor's ears alone, all the careful scheming, were here at last, coming to full fruition.
Power and fear. Fear and power.
The Baron could see the path ahead of him. One day, a Harkonnen would be Emperor. Not himself, and no spawn of his loins, but a Harkonnen. Not this Raban he'd summoned, of course, but Raban's younger brother, young Fade Rautha. There was a sharpness to the boy that the Baron enjoyed, a ferocity.
A lovely boy, the Baron thought. A year or two more, say by the time he's 17. I'll know for certain whether he's the tool that House Harkonnen requires to gain the throne.
My lord Baron?
The man who stood outside the door field of the Baron's bedchamber was low-built, gross of face and body, with the Harkonnen paternal lines, narrow-set eyes, and bulge of shoulders. There was yet some rigidity in his fat, but it was obvious to the eye that he'd come one day to the portable suspensors for carrying his excess weight.
A muscle-minded tank brain,
the Baron thought.
No Mentat, my nephew. Not a Piter de Vries, but perhaps something more precisely devised for the task at hand. If I give him freedom to do it, he'll grind over everything in his path. How he'll be hated here on Arrakis. My dear Raban, the Baron said.
He released the door field, but pointedly kept his body shield at full strength, knowing that the shimmer of it would be visible above the bedside glow-globe.
You summon me? Raban said.
He stepped into the room, flicked a glance past the air disturbance of the body shield, searched for a suspensor chair, found none.
"Stand closer where I can see you easily," the Baron said.
Raban advanced another step, thinking that the damnable old man had deliberately removed all chairs, forcing a visitor to stand.
"The Atreides are dead,"
the Baron said.
The last of them. That's why I summoned you here to Arrakis. This planet is again yours.
Rabban blinked. But I thought you were going to advance Piter de Vries to the...
Piter, too, is dead. Piter? Piter.
The Baron reactivated the door field, blanked it against all energy penetration.
You finally tired of him, eh?
Rabban asked. His voice fell flat and lifeless in the energy-blanketed room.
I will say a thing to you just this once,
the Baron rumbled.
You insinuate that I obliterated Piter as one obliterates a trifle.
He snapped fat fingers.
Just like that, eh? I am not so stupid, nephew. I will take it unkindly if ever again you suggest by word or action that I am so stupid.
Fear showed in the squinting of Rabban's eyes. He knew within certain limits how far the old Baron would go against family. Seldom to the point of death unless there were outrageous profit or provocation in it. But family punishments could be painful.
Forgive me, my lord Baron, Rabban said.
He lowered his eyes as much to hide his own anger as to show subservience.
You do not fool me, Rabban, the Baron said.
Rabban kept his eyes lowered, swallowed.
I make a point, the Baron said. Never obliterate a man unthinkingly, the way an entire fief might do it through some due process of law. Always do it for an overriding purpose. And know your purpose.
Anger spoke in Rabban. But you obliterated the traitor, Yui. I saw his body being carried out as I arrived last night. Rabban stared at his uncle, suddenly frightened by the sound of those words. But the Baron smiled.
I'm very careful about dangerous weapons, he said. Dr. Yui was a traitor. He gave me the Duke.
Strength poured into the Baron's voice.
I suborned a doctor of the Sook School, the inner school. You hear, boy? But that's a wild sort of weapon to leave lying about. I didn't obliterate him casually.
Does the Emperor know you suborned a Sook doctor?
This was a penetrating question, the Baron thought. Have I misjudged this nephew? The Emperor doesn't know it yet, the Baron said. But his Sardaukar are sure to report it to him. Before that happens, though, I'll have my own report in his hands through Chom Company channels. I will explain that I luckily discovered a doctor who pretended to the conditioning. A false doctor, you understand. Since everyone knows you cannot counter the conditioning of a Sook school, this will be accepted.
Ah, I see, Rabban murmured. And the Baron thought,
indeed, I hope you do see. I hope you do see how vital it is that this remain secret.
The Baron suddenly wondered at himself.
Why did I do that? Why did I boast to this fool nephew of mine, the nephew I must use and discard?
The Baron felt anger at himself. He felt betrayed. It must be kept secret, Rabban said. I understand. The Baron sighed.
I give you different instructions about Arrakis this time, nephew. When last you ruled this place, I held you in strong rein. This time I have only one requirement.
My lord?
Income.
Income?
Have you any idea, Rabban, how much we spent to bring such military force to bear on the Atreides? Do you have even the first inkling of how much the guild charges for military transport?
Expensive, eh?
expensive.
The Baron shot a fat arm toward Rabban.
If you squeeze Arrakis for every cent it can give us for 60 years, you'll just barely repay us.
Rabban opened his mouth, closed it without speaking.
Expensive,
the Baron sneered.
The damnable guild monopoly on space would have ruined us if I hadn't planned for this expense long ago.
You should know, Rabban, that we bore the entire brunt of it. We even paid for transport of the Sardaukar.
And not for the first time, the Baron wondered if there ever would come a day when the guild might be circumvented. They were insidious, bleeding off just enough to keep the host from objecting until they had you in their fist, where they could force you to pay and pay and pay. Always the exorbitant demands rode upon military ventures. Hazard rates, the oily guild agents explained. And for every agent you managed to insert as a watchdog in the guild bank structure, they put 2 agents into your system.
Insufferable.
Income, then, Rabban said. The Baron lowered his arm, made a fist.
You must squeeze.
And I may do anything I wish as long as I squeeze?
Anything.
The cannons you brought, Rabban said. Could I?
I'm removing them, the Baron said. But you won't need such toys. They were a special innovation and are now useless. We need the metal. They cannot go against a shield, Rabban. They were merely the unexpected. It was predictable that the Duke's men would retreat into cliff caves on this abominable planet. Our cannon merely sealed them in.
The Fremen don't use shields.
You may keep some laser guns if you wish.
Yes, my lord, and I have a free hand.
As long as you squeeze.
Rabban's smile was gloating.
I understand perfectly, my lord. You understand nothing perfectly,
the Baron growled.
Let us have that clear at the outset. What you do understand is how to carry out my orders. Has it occurred to you, nephew, that there are at least 5 million persons on this planet?
Does my lord forget that I was his regent Siridar here before? And if my lord will forgive me, his estimate may be low. It's difficult to count a population scattered among sinks and pans the way they are here, and when you consider the Fremen of...
The Fremen aren't worth considering.
Forgive me, my lord, but the Sardaukar believe otherwise. The Baron hesitated, staring at his nephew.
You know something?
My lord had retired when I arrived last night. I took the liberty of contacting some of my lieutenants from before. They've been acting as guides to the Sardaukar. They report that a Fremen band ambushed a Sardaukar force somewhere southeast of here and wiped it out.
Wiped out a Sardaukar force?
Yes, my lord.
Impossible.
Rabban shrugged.
Fremen defeating Sardaukar,
the Baron sneered. I repeat only what was reported to me, Rabban said. It is said this Fremen force already had captured the Duke's redoubtable Thufirhawat.
Ah!
The Baron nodded, smiling. I believe the report, Rabban said. You've no idea what a problem the Fremen were.
Perhaps. But these weren't Fremen your lieutenants saw. They must have been Atreides' men trained by Hawat and disguised as Fremen. It's the only possible answer.
Again Rabban shrugged.
Well, the Sardaukar think they were Fremen. The Sardaukar already have launched a program to wipe out all Fremen.
Good!
But it'll keep the Sardaukar occupied and we'll soon have Hawat. I know it, I can feel it. Ah, this has been a day. The Sardaukar off hunting a few useless desert bands while we get the real prize.
My lord, Rabban hesitated, frowning, I've always felt that we underestimated the Fremen, both in numbers and in...
Ignore them, boy, they're rabble! It's the populous towns, cities, and villages that concern us. A great many people there, eh?
A great many, my lord.
They worry me, Rabban.
Worry you?
Oh, 90% of them are of no concern, but there are always a few. Houses minor and so on. People of ambition who might try a dangerous thing. If one of them should get off Arrakis with an unpleasant story about what happened here, I'd be most displeased. Have you any idea how displeased I'd be?
Raban swallowed.
You must take immediate measures to hold a hostage from each house miner, the Baron said. As far as anyone off Arrakis must learn, this was straightforward house-to-house battle. The Sardaukar had no part in it, you understand. The Duke was offered the usual quarter in exile, but he died in an unfortunate accident before he could accept. He was about to accept, though. That is the story. And any rumor that there was Sardaukar here, it must be laughed at.
As the Emperor wishes it, Raban said.
As the Emperor wishes it.
What about the smugglers?
No one believes smugglers, Raban. They are tolerated but not believed. At any rate, you'll be spreading some bribes in that quarter and taking other measures which I'm sure you can think of.
Yes, my lord.
Two things from Arrakis, then, Raban. Income and a merciless fist. You must show no mercy here. Think of these clods as what they are. Slaves, envious of their masters and waiting only the opportunity to rebel. Not the slightest vestige of pity or mercy must you show them.
Can one exterminate an entire planet? Raban asked.
Exterminate?
Surprise showed in the swift turning of the Baron's head.
Who said anything about exterminating?
Well, I presumed you were going to bring in new stock, and
I said, squeeze, nephew, not exterminate. Don't waste the population. Merely drive them into utter submission. You must be the carnivore, my boy.
He smiled, a baby's expression in the dimple-fat face.
A carnivore never stops. Show no mercy. Never stop. Mercy is a chimera. It can be defeated by the stomach rumbling its hunger, by the throat crying its thirst. You must be always hungry and thirsty.
The Baron caressed his bulges beneath the suspensors.
Like me.
I see, my lord. Raban swung his gaze left and right.
It's all clear, then, nephew?
Except for one thing, uncle. The planetologist Kynes.
Ah, yes, Kynes.
He's the Emperor's man, my lord. He can come and go as he pleases, and he's very close to the Fremen, married one.
Kynes will be dead by tomorrow's nightfall.
That's dangerous work, uncle, killing an Imperial servant.
How do you think I've come this far, this quickly?
The Baron demanded. His voice was low, charged with unspeakable adjectives.
Besides, you need never have feared Kynes would leave Arrakis. You're forgetting that he's addicted to the spice.
Of course.
Those who know will do nothing to endanger their supply,
the Baron said.
Kynes certainly must know.
I forgot, Raban said. They stared at each other in silence. Presently the Baron said,
incidentally, you will make my own supply one of your first concerns. I've quite a stockpile of private stuff, but that suicide raid by the Duke's men got most of what we'd stored for sale.
Raban nodded. Yes, my lord. The Baron brightened.
Now, tomorrow morning, you will assemble what remains of organization here, and you'll say to them, Our sublime Padishah Emperor has charged me to take possession of this planet and end all dispute.
I understand, my lord.
This time I'm sure you do. We will discuss it in more detail tomorrow. Now, leave me to finish my sleep.
The Baron deactivated his door field, watched his nephew out of sight.
A tank brain, the Baron thought. Muscle-minded tank brain. They will be bloody pulp here when he's through with them. Then when I send in Fade Rautha to take the load off them, they'll cheer their rescuer. Beloved Fade Rautha, benign Fade Rautha, the compassionate one who saves them from a beast. Fade Rautha, a man to follow and die for. The boy will know by that time how to oppress with impunity. I'm sure he's the one we need. He'll learn. And such a lovely body. Really, a lovely boy.
At the age of 15, he had already learned silence. From A Child's History of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan.
As Paul fought the Thopter's controls, he grew aware that he was sorting out the interwoven storm forces, his more-than-mentat awareness computing on the basis of fractional minutiae. He felt dust fronts, billowings, mixings of turbulence, and occasional vortex. The cabin interior was an angry box lighted by the green radiance of instrument dials. The tan flow of dust outside appeared featureless, but his inner sense began to see through the curtain. I must find the right vortex, he thought. For a long time now he had sensed the storm's power diminishing, but still it shook them. He waited out another turbulence. The vortex began as an abrupt billowing that rattled the entire ship. Paul defied all fear to bank the Thopter left. Jessica saw the maneuver on the attitude globe. Paul! She screamed. The vortex turned them, twisting, tipping. It lifted the Thopter like a chip on a geyser, spewed them up and out, a winged speck within a core of winding dust lighted by the second moon. Paul looked down, saw the dust-defined pillar of hot wind that had disgorged them, saw the dying storm trailing away like a dry river into the desert, moon-gray motion growing smaller and smaller below as they rode the updraft. "We're out of it," Jessica whispered. Paul turned their craft away from the dust in swooping rhythm while he scanned the night sky. "We've given them the slip," he said. Jessica felt her heart pounding. She forced herself to calmness, looked at the diminishing storm. Her time sense said they had ridden within that compounding of elemental forces almost 4 hours, but part of her mind computed the passage as a lifetime. She felt reborn. It was like the litany, she thought. We faced it and did not resist. The storm passed through us and around us. It's gone, but we remain. I don't like the sound of our wing motion, Paul said. We suffered some damage in there. He felt the grating, injured flight through his hands on the controls. They were out of the storm, but still not out into the full view of his prescient vision. Yet they had escaped, and Paul sensed himself trembling on the verge of a revelation. He shivered. The sensation was magnetic and terrifying, and he found himself caught on the question of what caused this trembling awareness. Part of it, he felt, was the spice-saturated diet of Arrakis. But he thought part of it could be the litany, as though the words had a power of their own. I shall not fear. Cause and effect. He was alive despite malignant forces, and he felt himself poised on a brink of self-awareness that could not have been without the litany's magic. Words from the Orange Catholic Bible rang through his memory. What senses do we lack that we cannot see or hear another world all around us? There's rock all around, Jessica said.
Paul focused on the Thopter's launching, shook his head to clear it. He looked where his mother pointed, saw uplifting rock shapes black on the sand ahead and to the right. He felt wind around his ankles, a stirring of dust in the cabin. There was a hole somewhere. More of the storm's doing. "Better set us down on sand," Jessica said. "The wings might not take full break." He nodded toward a place ahead where sand-blasted ridges lifted into moonlight above the dunes. "I'll set us down near those rocks. Check your safety harness." She obeyed, thinking, "We've water and still suits. If we can find food, we can survive a long time on this desert. Fremen live here. What they can do, we can do." "Run for those rocks the instant we're stopped," Paul said. "I'll take the pack." "Run for..." She fell silent, nodded. "Worms." "Our friends, the worms," he corrected her. "They'll get this Thopter. There'll be no evidence of where we landed." How direct his thinking, she thought. They glided lower, lower. There came a rushing sense of motion to their passage, blurred shadows of dunes, rocks lifting like islands. The Thopter touched a dune top with a soft lurch, skipped a sand valley, touched another dune. "He's killing our speed against the sand," Jessica thought, and permitted herself to admire his competence. "Brace yourself," Paul warned. He pulled back on the wing brakes, gently at first, then harder and harder. He felt them cup the air, their aspect ratio dropping faster and faster. Wind screamed through the lapped coverts and primaries of the wing's leaves. Abruptly, with only the faintest lurch of warning, the left wing, weakened by the storm, twisted upward and in, slamming across the side of the Thopter. The craft skidded across a dune top, twisting to the left. It tumbled down the opposite face to bury its nose in the next dune amid a cascade of sand. They lay stopped on the broken wing side, the right wing pointing toward the stars. Paul jerked off his safety harness, hurled himself upward across his mother, wrenching the door open. Sand poured around them into the cabin, bringing a dry smell of burned flint. He grabbed the pack from the rear, saw that his mother was free of her harness. She stepped up onto the side of the right-hand seat and out onto the Thopter's metal skin. Paul followed, dragging the pack by its straps. "Run!" he ordered. He pointed up the dune face and beyond it where they could see a rock tower undercut by sandblast winds. Jessica leaped off the Thopter and ran, scrambling and sliding up the dune. She heard Paul's panting progress behind. They came out onto a sand ridge that curved away toward the rocks. "Follow the ridge," Paul ordered. "It'll be faster." They slogged toward the rocks, sand gripping their feet. A new sound began to impress itself on them, a muted whisper, a hissing, an abrasive slithering. "Worm," Paul said. It grew louder. "Faster," Paul gasped. The first rock shingle, like a beach slanting from the sand, lay no more than 10 meters ahead when they heard metal crunch and shatter behind them. Paul shifted his pack to his right arm, holding it by the straps. It slapped his side as he ran. He took his mother's arm with his other hand. They scrambled onto the lifting rock, up a pebble-littered surface through a twisted, wind-carved channel. Breath came dry and gasping in their throats. "I can't run any farther," Jessica panted. Paul stopped, pressed her into a gut of rock, turned and looked down onto the desert. A mound in motion ran parallel to their rock island. Moonlit ripples, sand waves, a cresting burrow almost level with Paul's eyes at a distance of about a kilometer. The flattened dunes of its track curved once, a short loop crossing the patch of desert where they had abandoned their wrecked ornithopter. Where the worm had been, there was no sign of the aircraft. The burrow mound moved outward into the desert, coursed back across its own path, questing. "It's bigger than a Guild spaceship," Paul whispered. "I was told worms grew large in the deep desert, but I didn't realize how big." "Nor I," Jessica breathed. Again the thing turned out away from the rocks, sped now with a curbing track toward the horizon. They listened until the sound of its passage was lost in gentle sand stirrings around them. Paul took a deep breath, looked up at the moon-frosted escarpment, and quoted from the Kitab al-Ibar, "Travel by night and rest in black shade through the day." He looked at his mother. "We still have a few hours of night. Can you go on?" "In a moment." Paul stepped out onto the rock shingle, shouldered the pack, and adjusted its straps.
He stood a moment with a paracompass in his hands. "Whenever you're ready," he said. She pushed herself away from the rock, feeling her strength return. "Which direction?" "Where this ridge leads," he pointed. "Deep into the desert," she said. "The Fremen desert," Paul whispered. And he paused, shaken by the remembered high-relief imagery of a prescient vision he had experienced on Caladan. He had seen this desert. But the set of the vision had been subtly different, like an optical image that had disappeared into his consciousness, been absorbed by memory, and now failed of perfect registry when projected onto the real scene. The vision appeared to have shifted and approached him from a different angle while he remained motionless. "Idaho was with us in the vision," he remembered. "But now Idaho is dead." "Do you see a way to go?" Jessica asked, mistaking his hesitation. "No," he said, "but we'll go anyway." He settled his shoulders more firmly in the pack, struck out up a sand-carved channel in the rock. The channel opened onto a moonlit floor of rock with benched ledges climbing away to the south. Paul headed for the first ledge, clambered onto it. Jessica followed. She noted presently how their passage became a matter of the immediate and particular. The sand pockets between rocks where their steps were slowed. The wind-carved ridge that cut their hands, the obstruction that forced a choice, go over or go around. The terrain enforced its own rhythms. They spoke only when necessary, and then with the hoarse voices of their exertion. "Careful here. This ledge is slippery with sand. Watch you don't hit your head against this overhang. Stay below this ridge. The moon's at our backs, and it'd show our movement to anyone out there." Paul stopped in a bight of rock, leaned the pack against a narrow ledge. Jessica leaned beside him, thankful for the moment of rest. She heard Paul pulling at his stillsuit tube, sipped her own reclaimed water. It tasted brackish, and she remembered the waters of Caladan, a tall fountain enclosing a curve of sky, such a richness of moisture that it hadn't been noticed for itself. Only for its shape, or its reflection, or its sound as she stopped beside it. To stop, she thought. To rest. Truly rest. It occurred to her that mercy was the ability to stop, if only for a moment. There was no mercy where there could be no stopping. Paul pushed away from the rock ledge, turned, and climbed over a sloping surface. Jessica followed with a sigh. They slid down onto a wide shelf that led around a sheer rock face. Again they fell into the disjointed rhythm of movement across this broken land. Jessica felt that the night was dominated by degrees of smallness and substances beneath their feet and hands. Boulders, or pea gravel, or flaked rock, or pea sand, or sand itself, or grit, or dust, or gossamer powder. The powder clogged nose filters and had to be blown out. Pea sand and pea gravel rolled on a hard surface and could spill the unwary. Rock flakes cut, and the omnipresent sand patches dragged against their feet. Paul stopped abruptly on a rock shelf, steadied his mother as she stumbled into him. He was pointing left, and she looked along his arm to see that they stood atop a cliff with the desert stretched out like a static ocean some 200 meters below. It lay there full of moon-silvered waves, shadows of angles that lapsed into curves and, in the distance, lifted to the misted gray blur of another escarpment. "Open desert," she said. "A wide place to cross," Paul said, and his voice was muffled by the filter trap across his face. Jessica glanced left and right, nothing but sand below. Paul stared straight ahead across the open dunes, watching the movement of shadows in the moon's passage. "About 3 or 4 kilometers across," he said. "Worms," she said. "Sure to be." She focused on her weariness, the muscle ache that dulled her senses. "Shall we rest and eat?" Paul slipped out of the pack, sat down and leaned against it. Jessica supported herself by a hand on his shoulder as she sank to the rock beside him. She felt Paul turn as she settled herself, heard him scrabbling in the pack. "Here," he said. His hand felt dry against hers as he pressed 2 energy capsules into her palm. She swallowed them with a grudging spit of water from her stillsuit tube. "Drink all your water," Paul said. "Axiom, the best place to conserve your water is in your body. It keeps your energy up. You're stronger. Trust your stillsuit." She obeyed, drained her catch pockets, feeling energy return. She thought then how peaceful it was here in this moment of their tiredness. And she recalled once hearing the minstrel warrior Gurney Halleck say, "Better a dry morsel and quietness therewith than a house full of sacrifice and strife." Jessica repeated the words to Paul. "That was Gurney," he said. She caught the tone of his voice, the way he spoke as of someone dead. Thought, and well, poor Gurney might be dead. The Atreides forces were either dead or captive or lost like themselves in this waterless void. "Gurney always had the right quotation," Paul said. "I can hear him now. And I will make the rivers dry and sell the land into the hand of the wicked. And I will make the land waste and all that is therein by the hand of strangers." Jessica closed her eyes, found herself moved close to tears by the pathos in her son's voice. Presently Paul said, "How do you feel?" She recognized that his question was directed at her pregnancy. Said, "Your sister won't be born for many months yet. I still feel physically adequate." And she thought, "How stiffly formal I speak to my own son." Then, because it was the Bene Gesserit way to seek within for the answer to such an oddity, she searched and found the source of her formality. "I'm afraid of my son. I fear his strangeness. I fear what he may see ahead of us, what he may tell me." Paul pulled his hood down over his eyes, listened to the bug-hustling sounds of the night. His lungs were charged with his own silence. His nose itched. He rubbed it, removed the filter, and grew conscious of the rich smell of cinnamon. "There's melange spice nearby," he said. An eider wind feathered Paul's cheeks, ruffled the folds of his burnous. But this wind carried no threat of storm. Already he could sense the difference. "Dawn soon," he said. Jessica nodded. "There's a way to get safely across that open sand," Paul said. "The Fremen do it."
"The worms?"
"If we were to plant a thumper from our Fremkit back in the rocks here," Paul said, "it'd keep a worm occupied for a time." She glanced at the stretch of moonlighted desert between them and the other escarpment.
4 kilometers worth of time?
"Perhaps. And if we crossed there, making only natural sounds, the kind that don't attract the worms." Paul studied the open desert, questing in his prescient memory, probing the mysterious allusions to thumpers and maker hooks in the Fremkit manual that had come with their escape pack. He found it odd that all he sensed was pervasive terror at thought of the worms. He knew as though it lay just at the edge of his awareness that the worms were to be respected and not feared. If... He shook his head. "It'd have to be sounds without rhythm," Jessica said.
"What? Oh. Yes, if we broke our steps, the sand itself must shift down at times. Worms can't investigate every little sound. We should be fully rested before we try it, though."
He looked across at that other rock wall, seeing the passage of time in the vertical moon shadows there.
"It'll be dawn within the hour."
"Where'll we spend the day?" she asked.
Paul turned left, pointed. "The cliff curves back north over there. You can see by the way it's wind-cut. That's the windward face. There'll be crevices there, deep ones."
"Had we better get started?" she asked.
He stood, helped her to her feet. "Are you rested enough for a climb down? I want to get as close as possible to the desert floor before we camp."
"Enough."
She nodded for him to lead the way. He hesitated, then lifted the pack, settled it onto his shoulders, and turned along the cliff.
"If only we had suspensors," Jessica thought. "It'd be such a simple matter to jump down there, but perhaps suspensors are another thing to avoid in the open desert. Maybe they attract the worms the way a shield does."
They came to a series of shelves dropping down, and beyond them saw a fissure with its ledge outlined by moonshadow leading along the vestibule.